This is Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin limnologist was awarded the Blue Planet Prize, a global award given out for environmental research. He talks with us about his work and what we can do to protect Wisconsin's freshwater lakes. Now, there's a good chance you've seen or maybe even been a server or a cashier dealing with an angry customer or an overwhelming amount of orders. Although that situation is stressful, the employee is still expected to smile and act happy. Our next guest calls that emotional labor and says that wearing a fake customer service smile can be bad for our health, and it can be a factor even for workers who don't directly deal with customers. Sarah Rifferjetti is an associate professor of communication at UW-Milwaukee. She studies the connection between emotions and the workplace. She talked with Central Time host Rob Ferret.
The phrase emotional labor, I think people use it in different ways as it's developed over the years. How do you define it, especially when it comes to the workplace?
Yes, actually, Arlie Hochschild came up with this term. She's a sociologist in the 80s when she studied airline stewardesses and bill collectors. And she defines it as the management of feeling to create a publicly observable facial and body display. So in other words, basically, it is when we manufacture emotions for the benefit of commerce.
And if I read your work right, I mean, we think of that as, you know, a cashier or a flight attendant or whatever. It actually comes up in more workplaces than just those public facing jobs. You've done some work looking at more behind the scenes emotional labor.
Yes, absolutely. So when we're working in an organization with other people and we have to fake emotions because we feel like that organization expects or requires those emotions, or perhaps we have to subdue angry or negative emotions, that can be emotional labor as well.
And then you distinguish emotional labor, I think, from emotional work. What's that?
Right. So emotional labor is about the manufacturing of those emotions. And there's surface acting, which is just the outright faking. And there's deep acting, which is when we might reframe a situation or do some perspective taking in order to adjust our emotions and get in line. But there's also emotional work, which is when we walk into a workplace that's laden with emotions and those emotions are just present there in the workplace. So, for example, if you're a first responder, that work is emotional in and of itself. And then the ways in which you manufacture emotions to do that work would be the emotional labor piece. So they're intertwined, but they're a little bit different.
Okay, so for the emotional labor part, we got to appear or maybe even make ourselves be happy, no matter how we felt when we clocked in. How do we start to figure out if that affects our own emotional or even physical well-being?
Yes. Well, this is something researchers have been working on for a long time. And initially, any faking of emotions was thought to be problematic. However, sometimes when we fake positive emotions, that can actually put us in a better mood. And then emotional contagion is when we catch each other's emotions. And so those positive emotions, like, for example, if you've ever been to a sports arena and people get really excited, those emotions can actually be good for us. So it's not always a negative thing, but when somebody is really negative to us and we have to pretend that we're not affected negatively by those emotions, that's when it can be really taxing for us to put on a smile and to address people who are maybe not as deserving of our positive emotions as we might feel.
Well, we're inviting people to share their personal stories about this emotional labor at 800-642-1234. I'll start with me. I've got a job where I have to, you know, even if I'm feeling tired or unhappy or whatever, I need to sound a particular way on the job. But the good news is I really like my job and it's really easy for me to do that. It's not like a lot of labor for me. Does it matter our attitude toward our job for like how big a lift this is?
Absolutely. So even one of the recommendations we often will give to employers is try to find people who align with the emotions and the value within the organization and the type of work that they're doing, right? So there are probably days where you come in and you're having a hard time. You have the benefit of not being on camera, which helps a lot.
Yeah.
and you've got some back behind the scenes time, right? You might have time during an ad to take a deep breath. So some of those factors of your job also probably help you engage in that emotional labor.
We're talking to Sarah Rifergetti from UW-Milwaukee, Associate Professor of Communication there, looking at this idea of emotional labor, when you have to put on a happy face maybe for your job or behave in a certain way, even if you're not feeling it. In some cases, can be bad for you. Some cases, can be pretty good. You could join in with your story, your work experience, maybe at 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller now. Mika is with us in Wausau. Mika, hello.
Hi.
And what did you want to tell us about?
So I'm just finding it really interesting. I think it's a very important issue to talk about, emotional labor, especially on both sides of the spectrum. I feel like, especially with the past couple years, it's been really rough for everybody, not only in the workplace, but also outside. I've been noticing a lot of managers, especially dealing with, you know, crazy shortages in staffing. And the problem I think that we're running into is that sometimes they can let their frustration come out on the workers who are already there. And then it becomes like this toxic cycle of like, well, now the workers are starting to feel like this brunt, this like lash out. And then all of a sudden it becomes like a whole thing of now we're bringing our personal life into everything. And then it becomes workers and managers playing therapists to each other, sometimes when it's like really difficult for everybody involved. And then it becomes kind of like this vicious toxic cycle of all of us dealing with everybody else's problems on top of our own. And sometimes it can get really, really difficult.
Mika, I got to add, this is something it sounds like you've experienced in your own work.
Oh, goodness. Every job that I work at, it always ends up becoming like, you know, it starts off amazingly and then all of a sudden drama happens and it becomes such a like overbearing presence on your workload.
Mika, thank you for sharing it. I hope you end up somewhere where that isn't happening. But Sarah, Mika, not alone, I'm guessing, that downward spiral of toxicity, I think she has encountered.
Absolutely. So just like emotional contagion can share positive emotions, emotional contagion can also affect us in really negative ways. And it's really hard when somebody's telling you to be positive, but they're yelling at you to do that, right? So I can definitely understand what you're saying.
Be happy now.
Yeah, be happy, gosh darn it. But there are things that managers can do, right? So if this cycle is happening, they can acknowledge when employees are really struggling and give them like just a chance to step back into a back room to kind of contain their emotions. The other thing you can do is you can kind of segment your emotions. So for example, news reporters that will go out to fairly graphic scenes will oftentimes segment their emotions and do their job and then acknowledge those emotions later when they have time to unpack and decompress.
Thanks again, Mika, for calling in at 800-642-1234. Sarah, when does this kind of emotional labor start to lead to burnout?
Yeah, so we did a study where we had people do daily diaries for 2 weeks. And what we found was if you're faking your emotions and you're engaging in that surface acting, on a daily basis, it will start to affect your moods and the ways that you're feeling in terms of feeling motivated, enthusiastic, lively. And then even in a period of only 2 weeks, it starts to wear on you in terms of burnout and feeling those negative emotion cycles. So everything that Mika was talking about, it doesn't take that long for that downward cycle to start. And so the trick is trying to catch it as soon as possible so that you can buoy up those emotions once again.
And I think that was the study where you were surveying IT workers, who I don't necessarily think of as public facing. Yeah, they have to help people deal with their problems. But it is, as we were talking about a little earlier, this emotional labor can even happen sort of behind the scenes. Are you fitting into the emotional, preferred mode of your workplace?
Absolutely. So when we walk into a workplace and we feel like other people in the workplace expect us to perform certain emotions, even if it's not in the service industry, but certainly it's more pronounced in the service industry, we sense that and we will perform as those around us expect us to, usually so that we can be good team members and be part of that job. So yeah, even in offices behind the scenes, we can be engaging in emotional labor.
Sarah Rifergetti is with us, Associate Professor of Communication at UW-Milwaukee. She's sharing her research on emotional labor in the workplace. And you could share maybe your own experience at 800-642-1234. Do you work in a job where you got to come across as happy, even if you're not happy? How easy is that to do in your workplace? How hard is it to do? Is there something that your managers or the business owners can do to help you do that? Call it at 800-642-1234. Or do you just genuinely enjoy what you're doing? So it's easy to seem happy because you get happy. 800-642-1234 is the number. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about the emotional labor you might perform at work. Sarah Rifrigetti is with us, Associate Professor of Communication at UW-Milwaukee. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. If you ever worked in a restaurant, especially out there dealing with diners, maybe you work in a department store as a sales associate, ever feel like you're acting at your job? Are you doing this emotional labor where you're keeping a happy face on even when you're not happy? Do you find it stressful or does it come smoothly to you if you support or manage people in that customer service kind of role? What do you do to help them? Call 800-642-1234. And have things gotten tougher over the course of the pandemic for one reason or another? Again, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sarah, suppose somebody is a business owner or a manager of people who, you know, deal with the public, maybe with diners at a restaurant, for example. They know they're going to interact in some tough situations sometimes. Do you have thoughts on how they can create a supportive work environment to help that be as unstressful as it can be?
Yeah, so the business managers can have some of that backspace for their employees to decompress. They can also intervene when it seems like emotions are running high and help navigate that situation. Employees can also be really aware of when they're faking emotions, and then they can engage in some deep breathing. They can also think about ways to reframe the interaction. So if somebody is yelling and screaming, rather than seeing that as that person yelling and screaming at them, they can think about maybe that person is having a really bad day and there's something else going on. And how can I generate compassion or a positive emotion to turn this interaction around?
We had a caller who couldn't stay on the line who says maybe this is a result of workers having less power in the workplace compared to previous decades with more unions and labor strikes. What do you think?
Certainly, there is always a power dynamic when somebody feels like they have to perform an emotion for their job. And so that's quite possible. I haven't done extensive research on labor unions, so I can't say that for sure. But I do know that the pandemic has been wearing on us, just because of the ongoing uncertainty and unrest. And so that can also heighten our base emotions so that when we walk into interactions, it doesn't take all that much to tip us over. So taking long walks, being aware of our emotions could certainly help us to regulate our emotions a little bit better, so that when we do walk into situations and we're interacting with people, we can act more in the ways that we want to act and be the people we want to be.
You mentioned the pandemic and how it may have made things worse. Of course, people in restaurants and stores have also been called on to enforce mask mandates. Those flight attendants we were talking about earlier, them too. I don't know if you're researching this now, but how do you see that affecting this kind of emotional labor and the stress it can bring to people who are working?
The mask is interesting because we can't see people's whole faces. And so it's really hard to read emotions when we're just hearing tone of voice and seeing their eyes. And so that can actually add an added burden in sensing other people's emotions and responding appropriately and also expressing positive emotions. I've been teaching in a mask now for a year, and you know, to try to just smile as much with your eyes as possible takes a lot of effort. And so just trying to navigate and use those nonverbal cues has become even more burdensome when they're taken away with masking. But also enforcing policies that you may or may not agree with can be really challenging. And so again, maybe that gets at some of that power dynamic of when we're doing a lot of things to navigate our own emotions and the emotions of those around us, it places a great deal of a burden on us. And so being aware of where we're feeling and how we're communicating our emotions can really help to open up possibilities to more positive interactions.
That's interesting, the mechanical detail of not seeing the smile. And I can't, they call it smizing, I think, in the model world, where you smile with your eyes. I can't do that. Have you seen other cues, or maybe use them as an instructor, like other ways to communicate positive emotion when people can't just see you smiling?
Well, so you just raised your voice. There was a little lilt in your voice, which communicated positive emotions through our vocal tone. And so that's another way that we can communicate our energy and our positivity. The speed of which you talk can also help. So those are small vocal cues, gestures. When you're seeing people, gestures can also communicate emotions. So just thinking really carefully about how can we listen for other vocal cues to pick up on emotions so that we can respond appropriately.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Scott is with us in Iron River. Scott, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. Really appreciate the conversation. And Rob, I appreciate your personal input there, because I often wonder about that being the upbeat radio talk host that you are. So anyway, I'm a retired school counselor, but I am still working. And one thing I would want to do is, I often, when I talk to kids in classrooms about a positive classroom environment and how that translates eventually into a positive work environment. And I want to put together a program involving music and a message about making an individual commitment to being a positive influence in the classroom, again, with a future focus on a positive work environment eventually. Any input would be appreciated.
Well, Scott, before you go, it sounds like a work in progress, but what kind of things have you tried saying to kids, and how have they responded?
Well, yeah, I try to make it an individual choice, and that it is a choice, and whatever we bring to the classroom, our individuality, that, you know, regardless of our home environment or our struggles with this or that, we can choose to bring a positive attitude to our classes and other things that we do in our lives. And so that it's mainly that it's a choice each one of us can make.
Interesting. Scott, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Sarah, any thoughts for Scott on helping create, it sounds like kind of a curriculum for a positive classroom attitude?
Right. Yeah. I can tell that he's really building this community among his students. And what I find really interesting is that he's having this interaction with them, talking to them about the ways in which they're showing up and the ways in which they're showing up that then feed off of each other to build this community. Right. It's really hard to leave things at the door, but when students can walk into a classroom and feel really safe, they're going to learn more, because the emotional flooding that they get from negative emotions, if they can turn that off, it will help them with focus, and it will help them to then generate more positive emotions. And I should say one thing, you know, positive emotions help us with creativity. They help us feel good. They help with something called organizational citizenship behavior. So we're showing up and we're feeling good with each other. But I will say there are benefits to negative emotions as well. So if we're making really tough decisions, it's better not to be in a super positive mood, right? Because we'll slow down, we'll think about details, we'll compare things. So while there is great benefit to positive emotions, there's also benefit to neutral and negative emotions.
Scott, thanks for that call. We're talking to Sarah Riffergetti from UW-Milwaukee, Associate Professor of Communication there, looking at emotional labor in the workplace and when it can get stressful. And Sarah, if there's somebody out there listening thinking, hey, this is me, I'm doing this emotional labor and it's burning me out, it's really a problem, I'm not sure if I can keep doing it, do you have thoughts, kind of a toolkit they can use to like step back, figure out what's going on?
Absolutely. So your body gives you cues all the time. And when your body starts to not feel good, you're gaining weight, you're not sleeping, you're having other issues, then that's a time to really check your emotions, figure out what kind of impact is this work having on me? And do I need to change where I'm sitting or standing or working? Or do I need to change something that I'm doing? And so really just listening to your body for some of those cues, because it tends to come out in our bodies in ways that allow us to recognize there's something going on. And then we can make changes in our lives that will help us be the people that really that we want to be.
Now, you've written a couple few studies on this already. What kind of research either do you have in the works or that you're curious about and you'd like to pursue?
Absolutely. I'm really interested right now in how students get out of difficult, stuck situations. That emotion of feeling really the stuckness, right? Mm-hmm. Really not able to move forward and progress. And so I'm interested in looking at that emotion and the types of communication messages that people receive that help them be resilient.
Interesting. So when you say students, are you the ones you're working with at the university level or K through 12?
Right now I'm looking at college students, but certainly the research is applicable beyond college as well in terms of how can we use communication in really productive ways to help people be resilient.
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Sarah Riffergetti is an associate professor of communication at UW-Milwaukee. She talked with Rob Ferret about emotional labor, how it affects our well-being, and what we can do to avoid emotional burnout. You can still let us know your story. Do you work in the service industry, or is your job public-facing in some way? Do you run into tough situations with customers, with the public? Have they become more common since the pandemic? And when those come about, how do you deal with them? What support do you wish you had from your employer? Email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org. Tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, the U.S. committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol is holding its next hearing. We expect to learn more about what happened in the hours when former President Donald Trump was silent as the attack on the Capitol unfolded. Join us tomorrow night at 7 o'clock for live NPR coverage here on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, a Wisconsin summer camp is providing a getaway for young people who have survived burn injuries. We'll talk with the counselors at the camp about how it all got started and the ways they're building community. That and more coming up tomorrow morning after 7 o'clock on The Morning Show. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, residents in Vilas County have raised concerns about timber harvesting practices from the state DNR. A reporter will tell us more about the issue and the DNR response. Now, a Wisconsin limnologist was recently awarded the Blue Planet Prize, a global recognition awarded to those for outstanding scientific and environmental research. He's been studying lakes in Wisconsin for decades with a focus on food webs, lake ecologies, and how human activity changes them. Steve Carpenter is a free-range scientist and professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Center for Limnology. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, first off, Steve, congratulations on this Blue Planet Prize. What does getting the recognition mean to you?
Well, I did not know much about it until I got the call awarding it, and I'm deeply honored. Now I know that many scientists around the world who I deeply respect have won it in the past. The mission of the prize is to repair and preserve the natural world that keeps us alive, and that is a pretty good description of the research that I've been doing throughout my career. So I'm deeply honored.
Steve, we've talked to you a lot over the years about what's going on under our water. I'm curious, though, what first drew you to studying lakes, and what's kept you interested in them all these years?
Well, I was initially drawn to them just because the science is interesting. And I had a professor who taught me ecosystem science when I was very young, when I was a sophomore and junior. Lakes just resonated with the ideas that I learned as an undergraduate. Over the years, as I came to Wisconsin then for grad school, because he told me that Wisconsin is the center of the universe for the study of lakes. So if you're interested in lakes, you got to go to Wisconsin. And I was a Midwesterner by birth and really loved Wisconsin when I got here. And over the years, I would say my research has increased in scale. So initially, I worked on the phosphorus cycle within lakes and the food web interactions and the ecological dynamics that control the phosphorus cycle. And then as time went on, I moved up to thinking about multiple lakes on a landscape, to thinking about regional systems of lakes and people, so how people work together with lakes and the land. Now I spend a lot of my time thinking about the planetary system of people and nature.
And Steve, you've been, as you said, researching lakes for over four decades now. Looking over that time, what are some of the big ways that Wisconsin's lakes have been changing during that period? What's kind of the tail of the tape?
Well, for one thing, we're seeing more nutrient pollution going into the lakes. And the reason is intensification of agriculture, primarily, and also climate change. So we are getting more storms, bigger storms, and those storms are increasing the amount of phosphorus, nitrogen, and other chemicals being washed into the lake. So that is one big change. Another change is that really for the first time, we need to think about warming water, warmer water conditions interacting with invading species from further south and from other countries, changing the food webs of the lakes. And when I wrote my first paper about climate change, which was about 30 years ago, we really weren't thinking about the interaction of warming with species migrations, but it's a big deal now.
And what are some of those species that are maybe having a tough time now that weren't that were maybe thriving, say, 20, 30 years ago?
Well, the most famous one is walleye, and walleye decline has been in the newspaper almost annually for several years. My colleague, Dr. Holly Emke, formerly from Center for Limnology and now at USGS, has recently conducted a study on where she tried to increase recruitment of walleye by removing the predators of baby walleye from a lake. And unfortunately, it wasn't successful, but like in science, sometimes you just have to try something. And when the cards come in, you read them and weep, and then you move on to the next thing. And at least now we know we need to be trying something else.
Talking with Steve Carpenter right now, Professor Emeritus with UW's Center for Limnology, recent recipient of the Blue Planet Prize. And Steve, on the positive end, are there positive changes you've seen in your time studying lakes or things happening now that hold some promise for our waterways?
You know, the project that has encouraged me the most recently is working on Yahara 2070 with a number of colleagues here at UW-Madison and also with people in the community. And in that project, we developed four different stories of how the future might unfold. And each story is really about a regional experiment we might do to improve the lakes. And after discussing those stories with the public, we then translated the stories and the public's concerns into computer models and into a short story contest, into art, just had terrifically positive discussions, I think, about mitigating the problems of the lakes. And I think here in Dane County, we're lucky to live in one of the most innovative counties in the world, in my opinion. And I've worked with land managers on several continents now and many different countries. And Dane County is just doing a great job trying to have the lakes coexist with agriculture and maintain a lake quality that that we can live with. I'm not saying they're done. There's a lot of work to do, but it's a really creative group.
And Steve, I know you're not finished with studying lakes and coming up with solutions for them as this Blue Planet Prize focused on. What are some of the things that you are still wanting to know or still excited about for the future?
Well, actually, I'm spending most of my time thinking about global change and about things like the climate problem. And I think the phosphorus problem in lakes is a microcosm of the global climate problem. Phosphorus is an out-of-control chemical cycle, and carbon is an out-of-control chemical cycle. And I think that some of the insights we're getting about working with the public on improving lakes might be translated into dealing with a carbon problem. And this is a topic that I'm working on with collaborators in Sweden.
Well, Steve, congratulations again on the award. Always good to talk with you. Thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to chat with you. I appreciate it.
That was Steve Carpenter, free-range scientist and professor emeritus at UW-Madison's Center for Limnology. We talked to them about receiving this year's Blue Planet Prize, a global award for environmental research, and looking back on his career on researching lake ecology here in Wisconsin, the U.S., and now the world. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about welcoming pests.
Ever feel like you're constantly battling garden invaders? Dealing with the weeds, bugs, and critters can be a never-ending, daunting task. Or you can roll with it, just like author B.J. Hollers and his family.
My neighbors did the logical thing. Rolled out the chicken wire, planted the stakes, and transformed their garden into a fortress. Sun and rain still had access, though no longer the rabbits or the raccoons or the deer. Much of the garden's beauty was gone, but the crop remained. Sprigs of parsley, carrot greens, summer squash. It was a price my neighbors were willing to pay. Meanwhile, our garden was quite the opposite. Unencumbered, free, and for every critter with whom we shared our neighborhood, a smorgasbord of earthly delights. My wife and I attempted our own deterrent, recruiting a plastic owl who served admirably for all of an hour, at which point the rabbits grew wise to our dead-eyed sentinel, viewing him more as a maitre d' than our tactical defense force. One morning in late May, in the days prior to the invasion, my 5-year-old son stood beside me in the yard and said, rather unceremoniously, "Oh, look, a deer." I turned to spot a fawn half hidden in clover, his snout bobbing like a dowsing rod. He lay folded atop a bed of needles, staring at my son as my son stared back. Two creatures too young to be afraid. In retrospect, I should have been the one to be afraid. I now see that fawn for what he was, the opening salvo of the onslaught soon to come, whose presence became so routine that some nights we all dined al fresco. My young family hunched in their lawn chairs, popsicles dangling, while the rabbits and squirrels made short work of everything edible. It was easier to marvel than be mad, and so we did. By mid-July, it was clear we had a problem. Not with the pests, but with our neighbors. While they worked hard to keep the animals away, we worked hard to recruit them. Had we been cable TV subscribers, we might have filled our time otherwise. But since we weren't, we took our front row seats in the lawn chairs, reveling in the animals' displays. Equally curious, the animals watched us too, shooting us looks which, roughly translated, meant, "Have you people never heard of chicken wire?" 6 months later, long after the garden was gone and our plastic owl was neck deep in snow, I peeked out the back window to spot three deer nosing through the hoarfrost. They were more apparition than animal, more guest than pest. I like to think they were a family, and that perhaps the littler one was the one we'd met in the clover the previous spring. That morning, when the deer returned, the world was so cold it could snap. So cold, I swear I saw a shimmer of heat rising from their fur. Long after they'd left me, their hoof prints held firm in the snow. A reminder, not of what we'd lost, but of all we'd been given.
BJ Hollers is a writer and assistant professor at University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every single Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, the state DNR is confident an investigation will show it's following timber harvesting standards correctly. We'll learn more about the story with a WPR reporter. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Knetter, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up at 6 on 1A+, the easy breezy lifestyle seen so often on TikTok isn't just aimed at young people. We'll look at why more older influencers are showing up on the app and showing off lavish lifestyles and peel back the layers of what we're seeing. That's coming up at 6 o'clock on 1A+. Now, residents in northern Wisconsin's Vilas County are concerned about how the State Department of Natural Resources is applying its water quality standards when it comes to logging and timber sales along shorelines. The DNR says it's been following its own rules, but an investigation is now underway by an outside organization. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. She's been following the story. I talked with her earlier today. Danny, can you tell us what standards these two northern Wisconsin residents are accusing the DNR of not following?
Yeah, so the Wisconsin DNR has forestry standards for protecting water quality, specifically near, you know, forestry activities like logging. And so they're accusing the DNR of violating their own best management practices to protect water quality near areas, near lakeshore areas that have been logged.
And can you tell us what your initial concerns were, where they first noticed them?
Yeah, this is something that started when, you know, these two friends, they got together and they were going out for an early morning hike back in 2020 in the Northern Highland American Legion State Forest near the town of Boulder Junction in northern Wisconsin. And so they were out walking and then they started seeing paint marks on the trees and they knew that, you know, that designates or typically designates a timber sale. And so as they got closer and closer to the water, they started to become concerned about the trees that were marked for harvest and felt that it was really a heavy cut or appeared to be what would be a heavy harvest near the lakeshore.
And how close to a lakeshore does the DNR allow itself to harvest timber?
Yeah, under the DNR's best management practices, they recommend a riparian management zone or this buffer zone of 100 feet or more whenever there's a harvest near the lakeshore. And that's to protect water quality. The DNR does have the ability to adjust, you know, those buffer zones as they see fit, as long as it doesn't impact water quality.
And the two residents we've mentioned first noticed this on Whitney Lake in Vilas County. Did they see a similar thing in other nearby lakes?
Yeah, Whitney Lake was just the first one where they became concerned. And after that, they began a more extensive process and actually kind of initiated their own evaluation where they independently went out and looked at 15 lakes in northern Wisconsin. And on some of these lakes, they actually went and counted every single tree that was marked for a harvest in that zone. And so what they found through their own investigation is that the DNR was violating its own standards on 9 out of 15 lakes, or that's what they're accusing the DNR of.
So these concerns were brought to the DNR. What was the response from the agency?
The DNR met with these two residents and discussed their concerns. They discussed it through emails and through field visits, but these residents still felt that they weren't in compliance with the state's own standards to protect water quality. And so basically they asked for a special audit from the DNR's auditor, SCS Global Services, who conducts annual audits of the agency every year just to measure whether or not they're meeting requirements to retain their Forest Stewardship Council certification. And that certification basically ensures that, you know, any products that come from the state's forests meet environmental, social, and economic benefits. And it helps wood products from the state of Wisconsin to remain competitive in global markets.
We're talking with Danielle Kading right now, WPR reporter based in Superior, looking at a story of two residents in northern Wisconsin accusing the DNR of not following its own standards when it comes to how close timber harvesting is allowed nearby a shoreline. And Danny, what was the result of that audit that you mentioned?
So the result of that special audit, at first, the DNR's auditor found that the first lake that they had initially filed complaints over, Whitney Lake, that timber sale had in fact failed to comply with the DNR's best management practices or standards for water quality, because trees were cut less than 100 feet from the lakeshore, and they weren't evenly distributed across the landscape. But the DNR appealed those findings, and last year the auditor kind of reversed course and said there was a misunderstanding between how the DNR and residents viewed that buffer zone and where it started. Basically, they said that this spot painted red line that marked trees in that zone was actually an area where logging equipment was not allowed, and it didn't designate that riparian management zone where they don't recommend that you harvest.
And what was the response of the residents then to those findings of those audits?
Well, they thought that that special audit was faulty and flawed. They were very upset with SCS Global Services and their findings. So basically they decided they were going to go to the auditor's auditor and ask this group from Germany, Assurance Services International, to conduct their own investigation and look into the auditor's findings and see whether or not the DNR is in fact violating their own standards to protect water quality at these logging sites near lakeshores.
So Danny, there's a lot going on here. What is the next step that you have your eye on?
Yeah, so the next step is that Assurance Services International has agreed to investigate residents' complaint. They're going to be conducting an on-site visit of some of these sites that are contested, and they haven't scheduled a visit yet to my knowledge, but residents are hoping that that will take place sometime this summer.
Well, we'll leave it there and keep an eye on this story. Danny, thanks for getting us up to speed.
Thanks, Dean.
Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. She talked with us today about concerns raised by two Vilas County residents about logging practices by the state DNR near lakes in northern Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, authoritarian governments take hold one step at a time. That's according to our guest, who shares ways that the media can do better at covering threats to democracy. We'll also talk with a researcher in Wisconsin studying forgiveness. That's tomorrow here on Central Time.